Well, Finance Division will come to order. Today is Thursday, March 14, 2013. We have five bills on the agenda, and Senator Peterson, Senate File 81, I believe your testifiers have arrived, and we'll start with you. Welcome to the committee. We have before us Senate File 81, Education Integration Revenue Reinstatement. And for testifiers for our tape, if you can identify yourself respectively as you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important issue for my district, the district I serve, Senate District 14, which includes the city of St. Cloud and Waite Park and St. Augusta and a couple townships. The thing that's unique about my Senate district is essentially that I have one school district primarily in my Senate district, which I think is a feature that makes it very, very unique. So you can imagine, as a representative and elected official from that community that serves the residents as well as the school board, the issues that our school district has are very, very important. And I think that's demonstrated by these two bills you have before you this morning, Senate File 81 first, and then next Senate File 82. I would just ask that you simply notice the numbers of those files, which demonstrates how early in the session that our office dropped those and got these this process started for these bill. Senate File 81, you will recognize, is simply just a repealer dealing specifically with integration aid. If you've served on a committee similar to this in the past, I'm sure you're well-versed and know a lot about this issue. It's a difficult one. There's many people that believe there's some significant inequities in that system, in that process. And I understand your committee is going to be working on this as you build your education omnibus bill, and we'll get addressed. I think this is an issue where when this repealer went in place, there are certainly some unintended consequences, and I think the school district in St. Cloud is getting caught up in that a little bit. As a younger man, when I first moved to St. Cloud in 1990, the minority population in our school district was significantly lower than it is now. It was in the single-digit range. Today, in 2013, we have over 30% minority population in our school district. And so, again, I think you can begin to get a picture of what's going on in our community and how integration aid is a vital, vital part of the budget that our Board of Education has to deal with on a regular basis. I would point out simply that minority population of over 30%, you'll recognize, is significantly higher than even some of the cities of the first class that you hear about on this committee as well. And I would ask, as you begin to again build your bill and deal with this issue and potentially consider the features in this bill, that you recognize that and work towards to bring some equity to this, particularly for regional centers like St. Cloud, where we have such a high minority population. I have a guest with me today, the superintendent of schools for District 742, who literally just walked in the door after a nearly three-hour trip down from St. Cloud, and I think he needs very little practice when he gets the chance to talk about his school district, as you'll see in a moment. We're very proud of him and grateful for the time he's invested in this trip today.
Thank you, Senator Peterson, and welcome, Superintendent.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak about the topic of the integration funding. We have not always been an integration district.
Excuse me, Superintendent, for the tape.
Bruce Watkins, Superintendent of Schools, St. Cloud Area Schools, ISD 742. Thank you. We've not always been an integration district. We first started receiving the revenues when we became identified as what's called a racially isolated district, meaning that we had 20% more minority in our district than our neighboring. We're touched by 10 school districts and had a far more significant minority population than the 10 school districts that we bordered. one of the rapid demographic changes that Senator Peterson alluded to is that if we went back 10 years ago, our percent of minority was less than 10%, and now it's well over 30. Within that, one of the more challenging things that's happened with the district is that a high number of our minority students are also new to country and English language learners. Even though our integration aid from the state is under 1 million and less than 1% of our budget, it has been so important to the district to be able to offer instructional support for our minority students. We also add the levy to it, and so we have another $300,000 to $400,000 coming from the local levy. This is something that I'm down because we hate to see it jeopardized. We realize that the original repeal would cause some changes. We don't know exactly what those would be, but my plea is that we are a district, and the largest district in central Minnesota, 9,500 kids. I have 1,500 English language learners, 30% minority, and I wish that I could say we figured out how to close or eliminate the educational gap by race. We have not been able to do that. We are making strides and we're working hard. These are dollars that are dedicated to that, and I'm here today seeking your consideration of the repeal or the rescinding of that and the continuation of integration funding for our district.
Thank you, Superintendent Watkins. Questions? The committee. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you alluded to Mr. Superintendent, at the end of your presentation there, because my question was going to be, it seems like even the Integration Revenue Replacement Advisory Task Force, when they looked at the issue, really never dealt with the issue of the gap. And I think, quite frankly, this legislature is going to be remiss if it does not deal with that issue. And where do you think we need to go in pursuing that problem? Because it was supposed to be one of the main reasons for this money, and no one is either tracking it or and if it is tracked, there really is no improvement being made. So where is the system failing?
I think the if I could, I think the history that I'm not totally up to speed on, but the history that I'm aware of is that the philosophies have varied about how to present the wording that accompany this philosophy. In some cases, it's been, let's make sure these dollars go to increase interracial activity between students, or and having a wording that might dance a little bit. In our case, we like to direct these funds towards instruction. We use them for certified staff. We've used them for paraprofessionals that assist in the classroom. We are trying to make sure that we're addressing the gap.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm typically the one that likes, in my philosophy, is to give districts as much flexibility as possible. But do you believe we're at a point where possibly the state does need to direct or have a more direct influence as towards the use of these monies for instruction purposes as opposed to the social aspect of it?
Superintendent Watkins.
I believe that clarification could be used, and I think that's a prerogative that you can exercise. I think that there are districts that recognize the best spent dollars they have affect the achievement of their students, and that's what we're all in search of. How do we affect the achievement?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Weber, you know, one of the challenges I think you can understand, and I hope the committee will be sensitive to, you know, our school district is we very frequently have students enrolled in our district that are above third grade. They're older than third grade, and they can't speak English. So our really what's happening in many of those classrooms, an additional expense our school district deals with that many do not, is that we have interpreters that are basically hired as contractors to help deal with that situation. And so that's an example where I think is very unique to the districts. It's something that I believe school districts in our state have not dealt with for many many years, if ever.
Superintendent, another follow-up by Senator Weber.
we've found that our district's in need of to serve the 1,500 EL kids, to serve a 30% minority. Our licensed staff and our paraprofessional staff, we've often sought bilingual preferred and then tried to add that to classrooms of the highest need. And that's one of the areas that we're pleased, and we think it's been a good expenditure of funds, but we're not able to do that for every classroom. In the EL area, we do receive funding, but the district has a $1 million cross subsidy for the EL. And of course, I mentioned that we get in aid from the state about $900,000. Our local levy on integration is just over $300,000. And those resources are also dedicated to trying to help achievement for our minority students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand what you're saying, Senator Peterson and Superintendent Watkins. I have a school district that has probably somewhat under 200 kids per grade level, and they have 20-some different languages spoken in the school system. So, but actually, aren't some of the English first aren't some of those monies actually supposed to be coming from elsewhere and not out of the integration aid monies?
Superintendent?
Thank you. That's why I referenced we do have EL funds, and we supplement those with another $1 million, not just that we receive about $900,000 in EL funds. The district in the EL services alone spends closer to $2 million, so we supplement another $1 million. This is in addition to that, and I mentioned that we're wanting to reserve it or preserve it because it's such an integral part of our delivery system now.
Senator Stump, followed by Senator Johnson.
excuse me. Some of my questions have been asked, and I'm not sure that there's really a final solution to the integration issue as to, the whole aid issue. I think there will be, but it seems like as I listen, it seems like it's really a revenue issue for school districts. if we had more revenue to, if the districts had more revenue, they could adequately take care of the problems. But I don't know. And I also realize that, poverty and has a direct influence on, the achievement that you get out of a school. I often thought that we needed to have a more defined plan and outcome for the integration aid. I don't know if anybody could really spell that out, but do you actually have a well-defined plan or outcome for this integration aid that you've been receiving?
Superintendent.
Each of the districts does have to have a multi-year plan that they're following. Ours was just renewed within the last year, pending what would happen finance, but we were told go ahead and renew. And in that, each district spells out the efforts that they are making. I do agree with you on the fact that this is also symbolic of revenue needs for school districts, but I would further say that, as I'm sure all of you have wrestled with, on occasion the need for categoricals preserves that the dollars designated that come to us as revenue are spent in the areas intended. And so as much as part of my argument on another bill might be for inter-fund transfer and flexibility, I can tell you proudly that the money we receive in state aid for integration isn't paying our heating, our lighting, or our utility bill. It's going for instruction.
Just one follow-up. and when you look at your plan that you've laid out for the integration aid, do you see progress from year to year in terms of what your goals are?
Superintendent Watkins.
we see progress in our community. If it's been difficult to have a baseline, it's that in each of the last 10 years, our percent of minority and number of students served has increased so rapidly. And because part of our minority service deals with a refugee relocation population, it's been hard to keep a baseline when we have kids move into the district that are 11, 12, and 13, and we're the first formal school they've attended. And so we find some distortion. They're exempt from having their data counted in testing for the first year, but we don't think any 12-year-old is caught up in through the seventh grade in a year. And so we're really dealing with some distortions on, but it also expresses the need when you have that exact the relocation problem or the refugee relocation that says maybe new to country, may not be English speaking, but by the way, they've not attended another school either. So,
Thank you. The record will note a quorum is present, and also as we approach our first committee deadline this week, we understand the necessity for members to multitask and be at other meetings as we progress. So, Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and to whoever would like to respond, I've spoken to Senator Pedersen about this matter, and it involves integration. And I'm wondering if if you're seeing white flight in your district, and if you could talk to me about that and how that is dealt with in your integration plan.
Either who'd like to weigh in on that? Yeah. Superintendent.
Yeah, I am sad to report that we are seeing white flight. If we do our demographic charting of total number of students, we'd see that our district has maintained a relatively constant number between 9 and 10,000. If we were to look at the demographic breakdown, we'd see an exodus, and our open enrollment would tell us that too. We see an exodus of white students as we've seen the relocation of refugees and the immigration go up. And so there's a little deception in the fact that we say, boy, we've stabilized. We've come to 9,500 each of the last 4 or 5 years. When in reality, we've seen a significant increase in refugee relocation. We've seen a significant decrease and white flight through our open enrollment process. Within the plan, we've tried some magnet status for schools, hoping to attract individuals back through science or STEM activities at one of the elementaries through two immersion programs, one Spanish and one Mandarin Chinese, and we do find that has some effect in it, but I can tell you there's a prevailing fear that the cross subsidies involved in helping to educate either the EL or the minority population, there's a fear within the community that detracts from monies available out of general revenues to support other programs. And so you accurately identify something that we're dealing with.
And Mr. Chair, and I've talked with Chair Wieger also about this issue, because my sister lives in Becker. And so she said, you have to find out, Alice, why we're paying for kids to be bused from St. Cloud to Becker, and then we're paying more money because St. Cloud becomes more segregated. And that is an issue, I think, for all of us, and it's probably... It's not about you or, you know, it's about what's happening and partly influenced by the changes that we make or options that we offer to people. And so I do want to call it to the attention of the committee also.
A follow-up by Senator Stumpf.
Thank you. I want to go back to, my line of thought before Senator
Johnson
asked her question. And it is really, I think I think there has to be a way to set a baseline so that even if it's a temporary baseline, you have some, or a school district has some way to figure out whether the teaching of whatever it might be, maybe English as an example, is successful. Otherwise, how do you even measure the progress of that particular subject area? I mean, I think the tools that many of us in here, I think, have talked about a number of times, and I know most school districts in the state actually use them, like the NWEA and those types of tools should be able to be applied in this area as well. I mean, progress from week to week, progress from month to month, however often they use it, so that you actually get a sense, or the district actually gets a sense of whether this is if not only progress, but also whether the money that you're investing as a district is worth it.
Superintendent, on measuring progress.
Yep, I should certainly want to assure you, first of all, at the lower grade levels, our general outcome measures are given multiple times during the year, so that's measured. I'll just mention one complication with that. We have one building that has 90 new minority students since Christmas. Now, we'll reissue the same general outcome measures and start a new baseline. That was the only thing I sure didn't mean to ever infer that we weren't doing both the NWEA at selected grade levels, obviously the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments. And so we do have measures and guides if we've had the students with us for a prolonged period of time. This is a very fluid problem that we're encountering, and I referenced it earlier, and I didn't mean to say that we weren't assessing, because we certainly are. One of the things that we know about our assessment, and this is going to sound like, well, you don't really need to tell us this, but it would relate to the revenue that we're talking about. All of our classrooms where we have concentrations of kids that could use grade level improvement, achievement improvements that have either co-teaching models or have assistance in the form of paraprofessionals, and in particular bilingual paraprofessionals, show stronger, faster improvement than those classrooms where we're not able to provide the extra assistance. That creates an urgency for us to drive down on a snowy morning and say, this is real to us, and it's important to us.
Senator Johnson has a follow-up then, Senator Bonoff.
And Superintendent and Senator Peterson, I really thank you, and I'm happy that I got through the traffic. I come from the northern suburbs, so I know what you were dealing with, to be here for this. I'm wondering if you have any sort of agreements with your surrounding school districts to help you with this very, very large issue.
Superintendent Watkins.
I wish that there weren't the turf issues or the territorial. I can tell you quite honestly that of the 10 districts that touch us, 9 of those districts are interested in the white flight that occurs. Not all students cost the same amount of dollars to educate. Mm-hmm. Some students come and go to kindergarten screening, and when asked if they can write their name, say in cursive or Danielian.
Mm-hmm.
Other students come to kindergarten screening, and when asked if they can write their name, we ask for a translator. I wish that I could tell you that all kids cost the same to educate. We have neighbors, and I don't think that this is politically incorrect to say, we have neighbors that benefit from our white flight, right, in the fact that students of mobile families that relocate are generally not expensive students to educate. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I will tell you that we're a regional center. We have outstanding health care in the area that attracts some medically fragile and high-need students. We have affordable housing in St. Cloud that attracts poverty. We have mass transit in St. Cloud. We have the ability to go to medical appointments, to the grocery store, and to the shopping centers with a token. That attracts poverty. The same thing that elevates the standard of living for many of us also attracts poverty and makes it an ideal site for refugee relocation. We need help dealing with that, and so I draw those to your attention. I hope you don't find them unrelated. I just wanted to share why we would be down here in a $100 million budget arguing for the $900,000. It's very important to us.
Senator Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my thoughts have changed since I first had my question. My first original question was about where those kids were going. Now it seems to be pretty clear where they're going to those surrounding districts. But members, we have a little funny thing in the formula that says not only do we give you the integration dollars, but if there's a district that's next to a racially isolated district, then they get that money. So I know it's a little bit strange where some districts really have no issues, but yet they get our integration dollars on an equal basis because they're next to a district with challenges. Yes,
Superintendent.
I would say, not as a correction, but as a clarification, it isn't really on an equal basis because that's a graduated scale of dollars per student, and so there is a difference. But it does go back to the original comment that was made, are we addressing academic achievement issues or are there other philosophies involved? And a part of the consortium, for lack of better, the surrounding districts that we embrace, is to have a greater exposure to interracial activities. Now, I'm not here speaking to that philosophy. I'm speaking for St. Cloud's need for the funding as we apply it to the academic progress.
And then lastly, Mr. Chair, I think we continue at this table to hear about the tremendous burden we're putting on our school districts to incorporate and handle so many societal challenges that perhaps really aren't best suited for each individual district in this model. And I would just call to members' attention, Israel, as a country, treats the immigration population entirely differently. They have self-contained communities where new immigrants spend a year, where the parents learning the language, the kids learning the language, figuring out the culture of the country, and then they get incorporated into the various communities. And I assume that they do that because of the burden that it would be and the hardship of thinking you can just plop people anywhere and just have it work.
Sarah Watkins. Excuse me, Superintendent Watkins.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention part of our...
If he would run against me, Senator Wigger, he would win. he may be a senator sometime soon. I don't know.
Be prepared for a dramatic pay cut.
I want not only to acknowledge that, but to indicate that part of our funding goes for what we call a jumpstart program, because the individuals, some of our students that come that are totally new to country, need that period of acclimation. The bilingual paras, the extra certified staff, we would have so little education taking place that first year if we didn't have a model like that. But I'm here to try to preserve that model, too, yep, so that we don't lose it and then say, what happened to that achievement? We were making more progress before that.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Chairman. I guess I would like to say I agree with Senator Stumpf that there needs to be a way to establish that baseline. The thing that, and I think the state maybe needs to be insisting a little more about closing that achievement gap. But at the same time, I think the state also needs to be a little more realistic. For example, the superintendent was indicating someone who has not had any experience in our schools, and after a year, then they get counted in the normal testing comparisons and that, and that doesn't seem to be very realistic either. So, and I think Senator Bonhoff's comment about the individual districts, we do need to be mindful of that because everybody's experience is certainly different, and so we may need to have some general parameters, but we need to allow them to develop the method by which they can best accomplish them, probably rather than prescribing everything from St. Paul.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Watkins. Mr. Watkins, I am curious about an issue. I've requested multiple times some information from the department, and I don't have it yet. But I, during the interim, I plan to do a review that actually tries to connect the issue of income and academic achievement. About 5 years ago, I was invited to visit some farms in rural Minnesota that opened my eyes to the farming community and how poverty is so pervasive in some farming communities. I am an urban person, and so the way I talk about poverty has been so related to my experience as an urban legislator. So a member asked me to go to the farms and really understand poverty from a different perspective. And then I learned that farmers were working, 15, 16 hours a day and making $20,000 a year, and that there was no break because the cows needed to be milked every day, including Sundays. So when I understood that, I thought, I wonder why we talk about poverty and academic achievement in a different context when we talk about a black child. And I wonder why is that when we talk about academic achievement, we only talk about race and also talk about immigrant status. So the language issue is a correct one, I think, and I appreciate your presentation about an assessment of a kindergartner, that comes from a family that doesn't speak the language. But I cannot equate that to race, I don't think, because it's not the same. And then if I kind of look at analyzing income and the income of many children who are white, who come from very poor families, who are doing well, I don't understand this. And you have more experience than I do. And you bring this whole issue of integration and race and language. Do you have any insights into that?
Superintendent.
There are two other forms of revenue that we're not addressing, but boy, I'd be driving down if we were, and they are at the state level, the compensatory education. And I'll be candid, our district receives about almost 10 times as much compensatory revenue for poverty related. The scale of poverty is what determines the amount of comp ed, and that's an amount that we receive that we couldn't function without, and we receive 10 times that amount as we do for integration. And so for us, that's the $900,000 versus closer to $9 million. And then at the federal level, it is the title program that is on the scale related to poverty. And so I just want to acknowledge, I really agree about the need for poverty to be recognized as a factor. And if there were another hearing in another room that said someone had passed a bill to rescind all comp ed, I'd be running over there next, because we receive 10 times as much in comp ed as we do in integration revenue, and we receive title dollars from the federal government. There are no federal dollars involved in our integration effort whatsoever. There is at the federal level through the title programs. I hope that's at least shows that what you say is not only valid, it has a degree of recognition through both funding sources, both federal and state.
Thank you, Superintendent. And Senator Pearson, would you like to make concluding remarks on the proposal, which we'll lay over as...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I did have one person that wished to testify in favor of the bill as well that I just learned about a few minutes ago here.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools, and I just want to say that we are delighted that both Senator Peterson's bill and the governor's recommendation proposes to continue integration funding. I have copies of our magnet school brochure here and some information related to some of Senator Stump's question about how we track some of our outcomes. The thing I want to point particularly is we've had an integration program. We actually worked on the original legislation back in the late 1980s, I think when Representative Johnson was in the legislature. And it was because we had been issued a non-compliance order by the Department of Education because we had failed to meet our racial balance goals in the district, and we had gotten a federal magnet grant at the time, which for the first time we were actually finally in compliance. And when our federal magnet grant money went away, we came to the legislature and we talked with the Attorney General's office and the commissioner, and they determined that the state did have an interest in doing the implementation of the rule. And so we set up a voluntary magnet school program. You're getting copies of our brochure. You might be getting one in Karen or Spanish or in Somalian in addition to English. It provides the option of voluntarily choosing to stay in a high-quality neighborhood school, choose a regional magnet school or a citywide magnet school. And so we do use our integration funding for both transportation and for the programs. And as to the new immigrant issue that was also raised, we do have language academies that we use integration funding for. And those are schools where, in addition to having some intensive language services, we also have social work services, services for parents, so that they can do the acclimation into the school program. So I know time is limited today. I also wanted to point out to you this information, which shows our graduation rates. And the district, in addition to providing choice to parents, also has a dashboard, just like St. Cloud does, that measures all kinds of academic points related to graduation rates, suspensions by race, growth on the MCAs, proficiency on the MCAs, expulsions, and the works. And that is publicly posted on our website, and it is regularly reviewed by the school board at public meetings. So in addition to looking at how we are providing choice in the district, we are also measuring many levels of quality and improvement in the district. And we would certainly like the integration funding to continue both aid and levy, because it'll be a 30% reduction for schools that currently get integration levy if the levy is not continued. And because of the way the levy is shifted for St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth, the cut actually hits us a year earlier than the rest of all the other districts.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Senator Johnson.
One quick question for Ms. Gilbert, Mr. Chair. And just looking at your chart about students new to St. Paul Public Schools, and I noticed a big jump in seventh grade in both areas. Is there any explanation for that?
Madam Chair, Ms. Gilbert. That's a very good question, and Representative Johnson. Part of it is that we do get new students coming to us from some of the private schools that just have elementary programs, we have elementary charter schools as well, and so there's the movement.
I think
the interesting thing, the superintendent from St. Cloud pointed out, he's experiencing exactly the same kind of demographic changes that we are. But that chart just shows you how we have to react every year, every grade, to the new kids that are coming to our school. And having a voluntary magnet school in place helps us place kids appropriately based on learning styles, because you have to have some of those options, because you can't change your attendance boundaries every year. I mean, it would any district who's gone through that knows what a nightmare it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Senator Pearson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. In conclusion, my understanding is the bill is going to be held over and for consideration. But I just want to thank you, Senator Wieger, and members for the chance to be able to come and talk about this situation, because as you build that bill, hopefully we've communicated to you that there is needs within our school system that are very unique and certainly unique to our district, but many other regional centers and communities across the state of Minnesota that really would be grateful for your consideration and some fairness brought to that formula.
Thank you very much, St. Peterson, Superintendent Watkins.
Thank you.
And we have had a joint meeting with the our House counterpart committee and reviewed the auditor's report, and policy committee has had a full hearing on this. So we share your concern. It would have a dramatic impact on schools, particularly in your district and in others, and because we're looking at a repealer right now. And so you'll see something, I would predict, addressing this in the omnibus bill, but as we learn more about revenue availability and excellent recommendations that have been made by members in terms of where we go ahead, we'll be more specific. So thank you again, and that
thank
will
you.
Be laid over. And our next bill would include both of you as well, Senate File 82, Senator Peterson, for St. Cloud District, one-time transfer. I believe we have an author's amendment. Is that at the members' table yet, the author's amendment?
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have it's the A-13 amendment.
Okay, Senator Peterson moves the A-13 author's amendment. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Okay, the bill's now in the shape the author would like. Please proceed, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What we have before you is something I think you're probably familiar with from time to time. It's Senate File 82. It's a one-time fund transfer, which essentially is money, if I can describe it, as money that is left over from construction projects, I think is the best way to simply describe it. It would be very inefficient in our view to go through the effort to return that to the residents through some type of repayment. And the amendment just changed a couple words, and so the bill is really just four lines that gives our St. Cloud School District and the Board of Education to transfer that those dollars from a debt service account into an operating capital account to be utilized for something else, quite simply, during these difficult times.
Thank you, Superintendent Watkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Once again, as we started even the other testimony, the topic turned to revenue, and so much of what drives a district's interest in being able to work with fund balances is the needs that are within the district. In this particular case, the debt service is a fund because in 2006 we passed a $35 million bond referendum and built a new school and made improvements throughout the building. We, according to statute, have the overlevy on that amount, and it generates 5% more by statute than the necessary amount to pay back those bonds. We are lucky enough within our district not to have a lot of tax forfeiture. We've not needed to dip into that, and we routinely build and accumulate that amount. And it is indeed returned or reduced on the levy or returned to the taxpayer when we have other needs that go unmet, and we're looking for the ability to transfer and use that in operating capital. Some of the expenditures that we would look at for that are in our technology infrastructure, in some security areas that we think we would like to increase either the use of cameras or within the facilities, increase the security measures that we're able to take. We have general repairs that come out of capital. We have a $4 million a year capital budget, and we have a 10-year plan that calls for $82 million worth of improvements. Now, we realize we won't be able to get to $82 million worth of improvements in 10 years with a four-year capital budget, so we'll be selecting the priorities. We're requesting the transfer to address some of those priorities. So it would be for technology infrastructure, for security, for building repairs, and a portion of it, we think, for textbook purchase, too. So I just want wanted to demonstrate where the need was and what we would be using the transfer for. Currently, it's a restricted area, and we're not able to transfer without permission.
Thank you, Superintendent. We do have the fiscal note. The amendment should probably be clarified. We'll ask Mr. Wilms to.
Chairman, committee members, the math is still basically the same based on the amendment in terms of the fiscal note, but some of the assumptions and the narrative within the fiscal note changes. As the superintendent said, basically what this does is eliminates some of the debt redemption fund excess. So this $650,000 will be borne by the local taxpayers by a lack of reduced levy. So that would be levy savings that would go to the taxpayers, but will be transferred back to the school district for use.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 82? Questions? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Superintendent. What is your, like, total debt for the school district, capital debt?
Our debt service is about $30 million at this time, and our bond issue that was passed in 2006 was a $35 million bond issue. That is the extent of our outstanding bonded indebtedness.
Mr. Chairman and Superintendent, is the the $650,000 that you want to transfer, is that kind of from the existing $35 million bonding issue, or is that from previous bonding issues?
I would. I'll use this clarification and welcome any interpretation assistance. But it's my belief that by statute, every district has to protect its residents and bondholders by what's called an overlevy. So when the amount of levy is calculated to repay the bonds, there's a 5% overlevy that, in case you live through a recession like we've been through and there's a lot of tax forfeiture, you don't default on your bonds and you're able to repay, and your school district maintains its rating and its credibility. That amount accumulates, the 5% accumulates, and by statute is untouched. And so it's sitting there on our books, and at a given time when it's accumulated, and I have to admit that I don't know the maximum accumulation that $30 million would be, then it's used to reduce the levy every so often. And so the accuracy of it would go back to the taxpayers means that you may have taxed at that rate for 4 years, you've accumulated it, and then your levy goes down, not due to a board action, it goes down to the implementation of a statute that says use the overlevy amount, and then it goes up the next year again, and taxpayers kind of look at you and say, why did it go up? And it isn't a highly visible amount, and it doesn't take a board vote to have it go back up, because the original bond issue was the community vote to collect that amount. But it is the 5% overlevy that accumulates for districts that don't have high default or forfeiture rates. And I'll ask if I've in any way misinterpreted what I believe to be the case.
No, I think
Wilms.
Chairman, Senator, I think that sounds correct.
Mr. Chairman and Superintendent, what I was wondering is if you were one of the bond holders that purchased bond, what's their reaction to you taking the school district taking the $650,000 that was supposed to be the kind of the extra security? If it's from a previous bond that was sold, I can understand that where you've paid off the debt and that. But here you have $30 million in debt. And so is this using the kind of the security blanket of the $35 million bond issue or a previous bond issue?
No, as we seek permission to do this, the number arrived at is a number that is below anything that we ever have to pay back. We also have the history of that in any previous bonds. I did mention we're lucky to be in a district that has not experienced the foreclosure or the forfeit rate that affects that, but the board knows that their obligation is legally for the repayment of all bonds. They've always upheld that. It's simply that as they do that, they see the accumulated untouchable balance that they would like to have access for transfer.
Mr. Chairman and Superintendent, you know, this is an issue that all 350 districts face if they have bonds outstanding or, you know, building projects. And I think it's not a big deal, but it could be a few years ago we kind of designed it so that it would be automatically, you know, go back to reducing property taxes. It's not a wise thing to eliminate the 5% overcharge because that gives a sense of security to those people who are purchasing those bonds. So that stays in place. I guess the question might be, what is the long-range impact if every district that has an excess of 5%, whatever amount that might be, if they all did their fund transfers, what would be the reaction on the from the investment community? It might be to raise the interest rates.
Superintendent?
Well, I'm more pressed to, from my point of view, it evens out your levy rather than having that go back and forth without explanation. Of course, we give the explanation every time, too, about why did it go back up. Well, that's because last year hit. But we would be open and interested in anything people thought needed to be a safeguard because our board's only intention is to access the amount that we see accumulated and then reduced in the levy and then increased again the next year. And so we're even open to, just at the time of rebate, which means you've covered every other one of those payments. This is not anything that we, and there would be no bondholder in jeopardy because they've received consistently the repayment. So this isn't any move that we want to jeopardize any of that.
Thank you, Superintendent. And Senator Pearson, closing remarks.
No, again, Mr. Chair and members, I just thank you for the opportunity to have the opportunity to talk about some of the challenges we face. This is one small one and would be grateful for your consideration as you're building your bill as it moves to the Senate floor.
Thank you very much, Senator Pearson, Superintendent Watkins, for both the proposals. And as Senate File 81 was laid over, Senate File 82 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Omnibus Bill.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson, with Senate File 251, you can prepare. You have your testifiers here, but I'm going to take Senate File 767. It should just take a minute or so. We'll do it right here. Senate File 767 removes obsolete language in statute, and we'll ask Mr. Arneson to explain. It's on the first-tier, second-tier calculation in 2006-08, I believe.
Sure. So, Mr. Chair and members, as you probably often see throughout the statutes, we sometimes phase policy or fiscal changes in over a period of two or more years. And this is one of those cases where in the mid 2006-2008, we phased in a sort of implemented or phased in referendum equalization allowance, which we're well beyond in terms of years. It has no bearing on our calculations going forward, and it's an opportunity to clean up the books and make it a little bit easier to understand for both those around the table and those reading at home.
Anyone have questions? Anyone like to testify? Not. I move that Senate File 767 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. All in favor indicate aye.
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 Carried. Thank you, members. Senator Peterson, Senate File 251, Compensatory Revenue Pilot Project Grants Appropriation for Certain School Districts. Thank you, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate File 251 is to continue the program called the Compensatory Revenue Pilot Project. As many of the members already know, compensatory revenue is distributed to districts based on the prevalence of poverty, poverty as defined by free and reduced lunch student populations. Also, that prevalence factor, the concentration factor, creates what I would call an inequity in the compensatory revenue program for districts that may have a large population of free and reduced lunch students but are before the point on that curve on the graph that kind of creates that exponential increase in funding for those very same students. What this program has been able to do since its inception is create some flexibility for the districts that maybe still aren't getting what we would consider to be an equitable treatment under the formula, but it does still allow districts to have some flexibility with those student populations and target some programs at closing the achievement gap, providing some early education opportunities and things of that nature. I won't elaborate on that too much, and I'll just turn it over to our testifiers here. I guess we can start with Denny Carlson here, Superintendent of Anoka Hennepin Schools.
Okay, welcome, Superintendent Carlson and Lester. And for the tape, please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Denny Carlson. I'm Superintendent of the Anoka Hennepin School District. Until the compensatory formula is fixed, we need this pilot legislation. As mentioned by Senator Peterson, the formula does not work for us because of the high concentration factor and the size of our schools. We have four elementary schools with more than 1,000 students. We have middle schools near 1,900 and high schools near 3,000 students. We build big schools because they are the most efficient to operate and what our citizens have been willing to support in bonded debt. We are short millions each year for what we need in compensatory programs, student support services, and interventions for students. We have over 12,400 poor students with free and reduced status, about 34% of our whole population. We have the third highest number of poor students in the state, behind only Minneapolis and St. Paul. And if we continue the trend that we've had in Anoka Hennepin for the past three decades, that's how long I've been there, we will equal the current poverty rate in Minneapolis in 2023. And that's obviously a concern to us. Yet we receive about half of what Minneapolis and St. Paul receives per poor student. We receive about a little over 1,200 and they receive about 2,400. And that's in addition to the regular formula allowance. Also, as mentioned by Senator Peterson, the local flexibility allowed in the compensatory pilot legislation is just critical to us. We can then focus on academic performance in all of our schools, use data-driven best practices, which we now know work, direct compensatory dollars where they are needed the most, and narrow our achievement gap even more. We currently have one of the lowest achievement gaps in the state in reading at 17.5%. We very much appreciate the seven-year bipartisan support we've had from the House and Senate. The last two governors have also recognized the unfairness of the current formula towards Anoka Hennepin. We hope you will once again support our 12,400 students in poverty. We do know this is a tough budget year, but we also know that we should be treated in a fair and uniform manner with other school districts that have many children in poverty. We would ask for your support of Senator Peterson's bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Yes, please proceed, Superintendent.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Keith Lester. I'm Superintendent of Brooklyn Center Schools. And the last time I checked, we're 80% poverty in each of our buildings. And And that means that very many of our kids aren't living in poverty. So what I'd like to talk about is what I heard in the integration conversation and what Superintendent Carlson just talked about, that sometimes we look at education as one size fits all. So let's give everybody a bunch of money, and it's this much per student, and we don't necessarily focus the money where the need is. And this bill, this money, is focusing the money where the need is. It's in high poverty areas that aren't being equitably served. And if we're going to achieve equity, we have to keep in mind, and this came from a report, a Pew Research report to the United States Department of Education. In order to maximize opportunities for access experienced by certain groups, a good society commits resources in order to level the playing field. And that's what Denny's talking about, too. I don't begrudge Minneapolis what they get because there's a lot of money focused on where the need is, and that's kind of the idea. It's just that it doesn't always happen in that way. We know that poverty is a documented barrier to school success, and so we know that we have a huge need. Among other challenges, I'm going to take a really small one for you. We are two buildings. We're 2,000 students approximately, two buildings. We have two very nice libraries, and we have no librarians because that was part of the $10 million we've cut from a $20 million budget over the last 10 years, thereabout, not 2001 approximately. And we're going to cut another $350,000 next year. You know, how do we tell where the focused revenue actually ends up going? Because when you're losing, you know, our hope is that we can add back, put those things back into place. I know today isn't about overhauling school funding, but it's about putting dollars directly where the need is. This revenue does just that. It focuses on the high concentration of children in poverty. Yesterday, I worked on a budget, and I commented to this, that requires another $350,000 reduction. Last year, it was $600,000. Before that, it was $2 million. So it's constant cutting. That means that we'll have another reduction in revenue in a place where the need is the greatest. The revenue in this bill would allow us to do what I call radical things. Now, this is sarcasm, like hire a librarian, maybe a literacy coach, and keeping our kindergarten classes right now that are going to be at 28 next year at 27, or however it may be. There are any number of things, and we will focus it. Right now, this pilot brings $75,000 to Brooklyn Center. That's a teacher and a part-time aide at best. And when you cut somewhere else, you know, you don't necessarily, you know, how do you show for it? So I would ask that you think about equity when you're looking at this bill, and you look at fairness, you look at leveling the playing field, not necessarily just equality. One size doesn't fit all, and I don't think it should, and that we should invest in programs, no matter where they are, that support the children that have the greatest need, or they support the children, support the needs, or help with the needs, I should say, wherever they are. And I'd suggest maybe that you put a face on those children who attend a school with a really nice library that's kept locked part of the day because there is no librarian. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Lester. Questions? Is there anyone in the audience that'd like to address the committee on Senate File 251? I was going to ask Superintendent Carlson mentioned on the closing the achievement gap, 17%, I believe, in reading. You've narrowed it down. And do you have any data, Superintendent Lester, in your district or other districts that are included in the proposal?
That show what this pilot money has done so far, accomplished?
Yes.
Not specifically, but I'm glad you asked because I heard that discussion last time too. Once again, in education, I hate to wax philosophical here, but how do we know that the compensatory money was the thing that did it? How do we know that the integration money didn't do it? Or, you know, any number of other things. I'm not covering myself. All I can tell you is $75,000 really kept us treading water and our head above water. Yes, I can tell you that we had, and don't know that we're going to be able to keep that person, a literacy coach in the junior high, and our scores on our Scantron, which is like the NWEA, have increased substantially for the group of kids she's working with. So, yes, I can show that, but I'm not sure if there are other programs in other places, too. It's, if I may, once again, sometimes we look at all of these things in little pieces, and it's a total package, and that becomes difficult. You know, there's a bill for bullying, and there's a bill for mental health, and there's a relationship. And so we'll never know whether it was the bullying bill or the mental health bill that made a difference. And I think that happens in this, too. But, yes, I can show that the literacy scores for that one teacher that we hired with that money have increased. Yeah. Not on the MCAs, because we haven't had the MCAs yet, but the Scantron.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions or comments from committee members? Senator Peterson, as you know, will be laying this over for possible inclusion. Senator Johnson.
Just one comment, and it might seem sarcastic, but I think it's really important for me to keep in mind that I tell people when they come into my office to tell me about things that are important to them and they would like support from me. And I say, you know, the only thing I wish I don't have that I wish I had would be a machine that generates money, because that's what it takes, and often. And so, you know, as we struggle with what's happening to the budget and we have to raise revenue, we want your support. We hope you're there with us. Thank you.
Senator Johnson, we definitely need increased investment to tackle these. I believe we all agree with that, and there's a lot of discussion, too, about the outcomes and how we get there and fairness. So that'll be our challenge. Superintendent Lester, we thank you also for your service. I believe you're going to be retiring with the district. Would you like to use this forum to offer just any, you know, remarks, guidance to us as we approach our challenge?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would offer this. I've been a superintendent in Brooklyn Center for 8 years, and the time when I see the promise of real new revenue coming to schools, as it should and should have, I'm retiring, and I always thought it would be great to work in a school district that had money, and so we didn't have to go out and scrape the barrels. So I thank you for the service that you've given our schools. I thank you for the consideration you've always given Brooklyn Center and other schools like us, and I encourage you to take every opportunity to make sure that our schools get the money they need and that the money gets focused at where the real need is. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Lester and Superintendent Carlson. And Senator Peterson, concluding remarks before we lay over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and at risk of taking up just a little bit too much time maybe. Just to point out something that Superintendent Carlson had pointed out, that this solution, or this Band-Aid, I should say, has existed across Democrat and Republican administrations, Democrat and Republican majorities in the legislature. It's a fairly small amount of money in terms of the global education finance package. And just to talk a little bit about why this issue is so prevalent in suburban school districts, if you look at the makeup and the concentration factor in particular, in inner city schools, they typically are neighborhood schools, St. Paul and Minneapolis, and that lends itself to a very homogenous student makeup where demographic factors are fairly consistent and therefore leads to those higher concentrations. If you look at a district like Anoka, Hennepin, and others, Osseo, they have large geographic areas with very diverse student populations. So if you go to the south side of Coon Rapids, you could have a 60-70% free and reduced lunch rate in the same school geographic area as an affluent area that doesn't have that as much. So if you were to go with the large school model, it dilutes the compensatory concentration factor and therefore severely limits the amount of revenue, which is what this program gets at. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. Senator Stumpf, a comment on the proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking in the budget books, and is the list that you've presented in your Senate File 251 the same as in previous years that have been included in the compensatory grant?
Or Senator Peterson, you're nodding yes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, yes. It's just a continuation of the districts who received funds under the last authorization.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Peterson.
I was instructed to point out, Mr. Chair, also to make note of the letters of support from the various districts.
Osseo, et cetera. Yes, we do have them.
Right.
Senate File 251 to be laid over. Thank you. We now have before us Senate File 462, which will be presented by co-author Senator Bach. Thank you for joining us. And if your testifiers would like to accompany you, and please proceed. We have before us Senate File 462, Taconite Revenue Levy Reductions Adjustments. Senator Bach.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe this bill, I got a letter from Senator Skoy that he wants to see this bill in taxes, so that's where it would need to go. So,
if there's enough Mr. votes to get it through, we'll...
Mr. Chairman, well, let me first say there's no cost to the general fund in this bill, so that should help with its passage. A little bit of history. The iron ore mines in northern Minnesota do not pay property taxes like other businesses pay. They pay something called a production tax based on the number of tons of iron ore that they ship off of the Iron Range every year. So what they do pay is about $2.40 a ton, right, the current law, in production taxes. It gets distributed much like a property tax would. Some of the production tax gets distributed in law based on cents per ton. Some of it goes to cities. Some of it goes to counties. Some of it goes to school districts, much like the property tax does. And then some of it flows to the IRRRB for economic development purposes. So that's what happens with it. So so that money that comes off of the mines to our K-12 schools isn't just an additional surplus on top of the state money. There is a levy offset in law. And what it says is that a school district's levy is reduced by 95% of the amount of taconite money that they receive from the mines in a given year. In 2009, we changed that language slightly, and there was an inadvertent error in it. And what ended up happening was their levy that was being reduced by 95% the next year was reduced by 95% of the 95%. So there was this drafting problem, so that eventually their levy for their schools will go away completely when every year you levy at 95% of the previous year before. So it really was a technical drafting error, and it needs to be fixed, or the schools in the Taconite Relief Area aren't going to have any kind of levy at all eventually to make up for the money from the mine. So that's really what this is about. We've got a couple school officials from up north here. If anybody has any questions, they can probably explain it, how it really impacts them in dollars and cents better than I can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Senator Bach, under the current law, it's really good for property tax reductions.
Well, you could construe this as being a property tax increase at the expense of the school kids.
In a given year, what kind of revenue is raised for the school districts?
Introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Erickson, and I work for the Arrowhead Regional Computing Consortium in Duluth, which represents 14 of the 15 Taconite Assistance Area school districts. And in answer to your question, the production-only property tax relief for the fiscal year 13 year that we're in right now is approximately $7.07 million.
And Senator Bach, it's pretty much full production right now.
Well, the taconite tax is paid on a 3-year average, because some years production's real high, and for the, for instance, this year production's about 38 million tons of taconite pellets. 2 years ago, it was 18 million because of the recession. The Iron Range's economy very much flows and ebbs with the national economy, because when we're not buying cars in this country and we're not buying appliances, the country's not selling steel. And so because of that, in order to take some of the volatility out of the money that goes to schools and cities and towns, because they have to set their levy and they don't know what their production's going to be, because of that, the tax and the distributions are actually based on a three-year average. It's kind of a leveling factor. And that $7 million, remember, just remember, gets distributed among the taconite relief area is actually defined as the geographic jurisdictions of 15 school districts in northeastern Minnesota. That's what makes up the taconite relief area. So that money gets distributed among all 15 districts.
Okay. Any other questions that members have? Senator Saxon?
If not, Mr. Chair, I'd move 1462 be passed and sent to the tax committee.
It would pass. The motion should pass it and send it to the Committee on Finance.
Okay.
And
I would move that we pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. Any further discussion? And did you have anything that you'd like to add?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Wertman. I'm the business manager at the Hibbing Public Schools. I've been there for about 26 years. Just in case you had any specific questions, our school district back in 2009, before the law changed inadvertently, received taconite levy replacement in the amount of $1.3 million. And so today, this past year, that number has decreased to $980,000. So it's over $300,000 tax increase that we now levy on our property tax owners within our district instead of getting property tax relief from this bill.
Okay. Great. The on Senator Saxhog's motion to pass Senate File 462 and send it to the Committee on Finance. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Bach. And members, I think, is that it for the agenda? And the committee stands adjourned.